Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I love Friday because that means it is time for our Week in Review. So let's get to it. This week, new revelations about years of neglect at the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Citations were still coming in. They couldn't be entered into the system, which caused a backlog.
Mr. Bose received an email with a photo of dozens and dozens of boxes languishing in an RMV hallway that he was responsible for clearing out and for getting to the bottom of. He did not do that.
Seven families experienced an unimaginable tragedy, and they didn't deserve explanations or excuses.
It is unacceptable that the senior leadership of the registry failed to address these known problems with processing out-of-state notifications or to elevate these problems to my office.
What seems really incredible to me is that for over 20 years, that nobody was doing this stuff for over 20 years. That part is absolutely incredible to me.
Plus, did the cover of yesterday's Boston Herald cross the line? But first, Democrats. Two nights, 20 candidates, and the gloves were off.
This is America, and we are strong and great because of this diversity, Mr. President.
Trump is a pathological liar. I tell the truth.
We need to call out white supremacy for what it is, domestic terrorism.
Mr. Vice President, it looks like one of us has learned the lessons of the past, and one of us hasn't.
The Justice Department came after you for saying you were engaging in behavior that was inappropriate.
If you want to compare records, and frankly, I'm shocked that you do, I am happy to do that.
Democrats win when we run on real solutions, not impossible promises.
I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
So let's jump right in here. With us in Studio 3 this week is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you.
And with us this week is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Welcome back, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
And you call us. What did you make of the debates or the scandal at the RMV? And did you think the Herald's cover yesterday was racist? Call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Okay, Tom, Michael, kind of a marathon week with the debates, 2.5 hours over two nights. That's like two movies. What stood out to each of you? Michael.
Well, one, I think, you know, I always, as we looked at both nights, I could only think about musical chairs. And when you have like 20 people circling around to grab a seat that you're looking forward to when it's a smaller number of people. And I think we're at that place. I think there was some robust, some really rich conversations around national security, around race, around immigration policies. And I think I was impressed, particularly in the first night, a little different on the second night. But I'm impressed with the wealth of candidates, the wealth of knowledge within the candidates. Bernie, Senator Warren, very impressed by. Biden did a better job. So I think we're looking at a very good race leading into this summer.
So kind of a solid stock there.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah.
How about you, Tom? What were your initial reactions?
Well, two. The first was this sort of sense of dread that we've got five more of these to go before we actually have the first caucus. And that really is going to be tough. I do think what we saw here, first of all, you know, we're not seeing someone win or lose here. We're really seeing the field getting winnowed.
Right.
But I think we are also seeing a few the party trying to define itself, both philosophically and generationally. And I think that's the play that we see among all of these people. Is it going to be the old guard versus the establishment, young versus old, middle of the road versus far left? And I think they're trying to lay out for voters right now what it is they offer. When we finally get to February, we're going to start to see what the voters actually think about all of these positions.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you want to call us. Michael, you were nodding vigorously while Tom was speaking, so share some of that with us.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I think people complain about the number of candidates, but I think that there is something very valuable about it, the number of candidates. It creates a conversation that is rich and has a lot of perspectives, and it's the intergenerational issues. It's race, it's immigration perspectives. I think though I'm also concerned that there are so many candidates and they're sort of beating each other up at this part, I know that it's good for democracy, it's good for the Democratic Party that there is a strong conversation and a diverse conversation happening there.
So to this idea of the pressure and tension of the conversation, I want to play some of an interaction that we had here on the show Radio Boston this week between two of our political analysts. One was former Massachusetts Congressman Mike Capuano, and the other was Reverend Mariama White Hammond. We had a caller who had called in and said, I love it that we're stretching these issues, Medicare for all, socialism, open borders. Capuano thought that wasn't very helpful.
We're giving 2, 3, 4, 5 major divisive issues to Donald Trump to drive a train through when they are not necessary to espouse our positions that we do agree on, namely that we do have to do something on health care, we do have to do something on retirement, and on and on and on.
I have deep respect for the congressman, but I also live in that district, and the sentiments are shifting. There's a shift that allowed Donald Trump to get in. There's a shift that allowed the folks in the squad to get in. There's a shift happening in this country. And I think almost none of us really know how it's going to go down.
Go ahead.
Disagreement is exactly what the primary is about.
Right.
Tom Keene, do you agree?
I disagree with Capuano to the extent that I think him saying that we really shouldn't be having all of this disagreement and that we really shouldn't be handing these quote-unquote opportunities to Donald Trump to launch a campaign. I think the Democrats have to debate this stuff. We can't not keep quiet about it and not say, oh, we're not going to give an opportunity for the Trump campaign eventually to hold people to their words. It may be a problem. It may not. I also really think that we're well over a year in advance of the election. This stuff will be forgotten about. We really will see a very different dynamic once we actually get to the primaries.
What do you think, listeners? Is this healthy for the Democratic Party at this point? 1-800-423-8255. Michael, I did find myself after Thursday night thinking, wow, there is some blood on the floor.
Yeah.
And I did wonder from the perspective of the Democratic Party, are they handing ammunition to the GOP for the general election with whomever winds up as the nominee?
I mean, it could be, but I look at it differently. I think similar to Reverend Mariana White Hammond, I look at this as a new time. We can now have conversations around, though we appreciate the ACA, how do we expand access to health care to more people, right? ACA did not provide health care to everyone. It actually left millions of people out. How do we deal with quality and cost in the system? Those are rich conversations that we should be having and the Democratic Party should be leaning on. If it's about how do we create borders that allow more people in and have an opportunity to become citizens, that is the Democratic Party's charge to do that. So if we left it to, and no disrespect to Congressman Capuano, there's a conservatism even within the Democratic Party that just wants to say, hey, this is a political thing. We want to win. But you have the new generation, that next generation is pushing the issues and challenging the party to actually live up to its ideals. And I think that's it's a good time to be a Democrat right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paula from Billerica, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm really tired about hearing this is far left. Marcuse was far left. Richard M. Nixon, his policies were not further to the right than what Warren and Sanders are talking about. It's like they're not calling for the abolishment of private enterprise. Why are they being called far left? Things have moved to the right wing, and I'm really tired of this.
Okay, so thanks for that, Paula. And Tom, it is interesting if one argues, listen, the middle shifted further right, therefore what used to look like kind of regular left might look like far left now. What do you think of that argument?
Well, the point about Nixon is actually a pretty good one because I remember when Nixon imposed wage and price controls, which is actually almost an unimaginable thing today in terms of having the government literally dictate the prices of everything. And you actually, if you want to change your price, you actually needed to get permission to do it. So in one respect, it's really true. The middle has really shifted. Democrats, who were once the anti-war party, anti-defense, became very much the party of national security. You have seen those shifts. On the other hand, in today's context, what Warren and Bernie Sanders are proposing in terms of abolishing private health care, moving to a national system, really is a very out there, significant change to what we have had throughout the history of the United States.
So I want to shift the focus of the conversation a little bit. One of our other commentators earlier this week, Tom Nichols, lamented that the person who came out best from the debates was President Donald Trump. There wasn't a lot of focus on him, but every once in a while, one of the candidates would turn their attention, as Kirsten Gillibrand did. Let's listen to that.
So the first thing that I'm going to do when I'm president is I'm going to Clorox the Oval Office. The second thing I'm going to do is I will re-engage on global climate change. And I will not only sign the Paris Global Climate Accords, but I will lead a worldwide conversation about the urgency of this crisis.
One has heard over the last couple of years all kinds of conversations about what we do and don't normalize. It was interesting to me that we would hear a comment like, I'm going to Clorox the Oval Office, as part of a serious presidential debate. What else is the new normal now as we're going into this 2020 presidential race? And that's for either of you.
Yeah, it's funny because I think Donald Trump has lowered the bar significantly. And I think if you're a Democrat, and particularly some of the candidates, they know that if they go into a general election against Donald Trump, they're going to have what I call the third mile attack, as for Eminem, the rappers who know the Eminem. But the quips, the comebacks, the sarcastic comments, you know, I think that's why people actually like Joe Biden, is they think he will be able to do that. Kamala Harris will be able to do that. It's not a good feel for those of us who are listening. But unfortunately, the American public tends to like that. They want to hear the quick liners. I want to hear the substance. And I think most of us, many of us, want to hear the substance. And although that was a good line, I prefer the debate we're talking about Medicare and immigration and racial justice, criminal justice issues.
So there was another conversation that happened that seemed like a new normal, which was there was a discussion on stage about reparations. Let's hear Marianne Williamson.
If you did the math of the 40 acres and a mule, given that there was 4 to 5 million slaves at the end of the Civil War, they're fortified, and they were all promised 40 acres and a mule for every family of four. If you did the math today, it would be trillions of dollars.
Tom, how does the Democratic Party have a conversation with something about something like reparations when clearly the moment has come to do that in the party, when the other party is constantly tagging them for being overly focused on race?
Well, I think actually that exposes this huge gulf that I worry about between the Democrats and the rest of the country. And that is that the Democrats and you know, living on the coast, and whether you're East Coast or West Coast, we tend to be in the bubble. We are all hearing this stuff and kind of liking this stuff, but this is probably, and I fear, the stuff that alienates people who are more in the middle. Donald Trump right now is disliked by more voters than he's liked. And yet I could really see a circumstance where a Democratic Party that pushes too far is going to alienate those voters who will vote for Donald Trump even if they have to hold their noses to do it.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take some calls. We've got Lisa from Peabody on the line. Lisa, what did you think of the debates?
Well, I love the debates. I thought it was important to listen to all of this. But as you said, some Democrats, like, I think they're pushing to the too much. Like, I'm scared about the government taking over insurance, for example, and forcing people to do exactly what they want. Like, I would love to keep my private insurance, or at least to have a choice to do so.
Thanks for that, Lisa.
Yeah.
So, Michael Curry, so we, you know, pushing the envelope, reparations,
yep,
Medicare for all, go after the corporations and big pharma.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that envelope pushing?
So I think it's a great thing. I think we understand the purpose of a primary is really to vet these issues, is to have that kind of a rich debate within the party, Republican Party or the Democratic Party. And this is what this is for. It's to really make us think about the how we provide health care and health insurance in this country and whether we're providing care. And that debate plays out on stage, but then we get to go back and debate each other in the rooms and in the coffee houses. So I think it works. Whether that is what we're advocating for when it comes down to the Democratic candidate and Republican is always a different story. But it's a rich debate that we need. And I think for those of us who don't understand how health insurance works and how immigration works and what racial history, as we just said, around race, people don't understand what this reparations conversation has been on the table for a long time and ignored by most white Americans because they didn't know American history. Now it's a conversation on what reparations could look like, what it should be, and whether it's a viable option to reposition Black America that has historically been disadvantaged due to race.
Tom, it sounded like you also wanted to respond to that call.
So, yeah, I mean, I think when you say Democrats are talking, it's not really Democrats are talking. Some Democrats are proposing reparations. Some Democrats are talking about nationalized health care. Other Democrats on that stage are clearly adopting a different position, including, for example, Joe Biden, who really just wants to enhance Obamacare. So I think I really agree with Michael here that what you are having is the party trying to figure this out. Eventually, we will have a nominee that's going to have a set of positions. I don't know who that nominee will be or what those positions will be.
So, Michael, I found myself thinking a number of times, this feels to me very similar to the struggle for the soul of the Republican Party in 2016.
Right.
Do you see parallels here as well?
I do. You know, I always said that we should do a caricature of Donald Trump on a yellow bus with his hair looking crazy with the big wheel, because he basically took over and hijacked the Republican Party. And show all the Republican leadership with their face pressed against the window looking crazy and terrified. But then they settle.
This is a very strong image.
And they settle in their seats as they see repeal Roe v. Wade, anti-Black Lives Matter, keep the LGBTQ out of the military. And they're starting to settle, but it's a Faustian bargain. They've made a deal with the devil. I think that they swung very far to the right because Donald Trump knew that that would get him elected. There is a necessary conversation around what the left looks like. And we'll end up where we need to be.
All right, let's take one more call before the break. David from Brighton, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my concern is that when the Democrats talk about having both a public option and maintaining the private option, that there's not been enough analysis that those two are sustainable. That is, if the private option is a richer benefit, sicker people will pay a little bit more and want to go and want to stay in or obtain the private option, which of course will be adverse selection, which will make the whole combination unsustainable.
Let's let Tom Keene address that, David. Thanks for calling
in,
Tom.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Mean, that adverse selection issue was the whole thing behind Obamacare, right? And why the only way it would work would be to have everyone compelled to buy health insurance in some fashion.
With the individual mandate.
Right, with the individual mandate. And I think he's right. I mean, we are only at the beginning stages about talking what a healthcare system might look like. I think one of the things we're going to find out, because we found this out as we went through the whole debate with Obamacare, is that this is horrendously complicated and that a simple solution is not going to be out there.
All right, Tom Keene, Michael Curry, please stick around for a short break. Radio Boston's Week in Review is going to continue with your calls on the latest in the RMV scandal. Should the buck stop further up the political ladder? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are continuing this Week in Review. Still with us here in Studio 3 is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, and Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thanks to both of you for sticking around.
Thank you.
And you're still with us. Call us. What did you make of the revelation this week that the Registry of Motor Vehicles had never processed out-of-state driving violations prior to 2016. Call us. Let us know what you think at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Tom, Michael, for a little more context, this week the hearing that was supposed to happen last week but got ghosted actually took place. You'll remember there was a bit of a standoff between the Baker administration and the legislature after a much-anticipated hearing fell apart because a lot of key folks didn't appear. They did the hearing this week and heard, including from former Registrar Aaron Devaney.
Seven families experienced an unimaginable tragedy, and they didn't deserve explanations or excuses. They deserve to have someone be accountable and acknowledge that the service that the Registry of Motor Vehicles provided was unacceptable in this instance.
Now, of course, Devaney had resigned in June, but what were your reactions to the revelations this week?
Well, one, I'm always shocked that we're shocked, right? I think when we think about the RMV, we think about DCF. There are always inherent issues that we run across with certain agencies. And RMV goes back, the issues with the RMV go back several administrations under every governor I can think of. this particular revelation that they weren't doing their jobs to make sure that they took in the violations and records from other states and then shared them with other states is disturbing, because of course that means that they weren't going after and holding accountable people who should not have licenses here in Massachusetts. So, I'm not shocked that there's more dysfunction at the RMV. I am a little shocked that this governor, who is typically the take hold type of governor, has not taken hold of this, taken accountability for it, not blamed past administrations, but said we're going to solve this and put the resources and the right people behind it to do it.
Tom, has Governor Baker failed to take hold? Do you agree with Michael?
Yeah, I do agree with Michael on this one. It really is. Charlie Baker's whole thing was that he really got government and loved the fact that government can actually deliver services. And I'm really amazed that it's now kind of – I'm shocked to hear this has been going on for 20 years. It really was the line almost out of Casablanca.
Sorry, I thought you were going to say more. Right. And then I realized, oh, no, that's actually a really good quote. You threw me off for a second. So, and it raises this weird thing, right, because we were talking about this. Now, we've seen some pretty tough stuff at the state police. We've seen some tough stuff the last several years in DCF. We've seen tough stuff in the RMV. We do have a governor. And transportation. Yeah. So are we seeing some level of kind of categorical mismanagement in state institutions? Do we have a problem with government efficacy?
Well, I don't know if that's the case. I think there are certain parts of government, no matter what city, what state you're in, that are just challenging to rein in and control. And I think they're probably consistent across the country. And child services, transportation are those examples. However, I think here, this governor, as was said, has a record of saying that he take charge and he understands government. He comes out of working in prior administrations. I think there's an opportunity for him here to not blame anyone else, but just to take charge and solve it and make sure that he solves it for the next governor coming in.
Yeah, I'm a little worried, though, that what we're hearing are cries for more resignations, which is kind of the standard way you deal with a crisis. And, yeah, we can get rid of people and then bring new people in, but that doesn't systematically change the problem of how the agency is operating. My hope is that instead of just firing people,
yes,
we actually talk about how we reorganize.
Okay, I hear you on that. I do want to pick up a bit of testimony from Thomas Bowes, who was the director of the RMV's Merit Rating Board, his testimony.
Citations were still coming in. They couldn't be entered into the system, which caused a backlog of citations needing to be entered into the system. And we couldn't enter anything as far as the out-of-state violations was concerned.
State Senator Eric Lesser is calling for the ouster of Mr. Bowes.
Mr. Bowes received an email with a photo of dozens and dozens of boxes languishing in an RMV hallway that he was responsible for clearing out and for getting to the bottom of. He did not do that. If that's not a reason for someone to resign or be fired, quite frankly, I don't know what is.
So, Michael, do you agree with Tom? Listen, resignations aren't really what's going to fix this. Do we also have to have resignations? What do you think?
So I think, you know, what we as voters, we as citizens always look for is transparency and accountability. And this is a case of accountability. If it's a case of whether you knew or should have known, and this is that. There should be people who have to leave the administration because they were not responsive, and they did not prevent this death. And this was preventable deaths. If they had done what they should have done and what they were accountable for.
So yeah. Listeners are actually blowing up the phones. Let's take some calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lisa from Taunton, what's on your mind about the RMV? Lisa, do we still have you?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, so I don't think it's true that they're not getting citations from other states, or they didn't in the past, because I did get a citation from New Hampshire, and I got a notice saying, if you don't pay this speeding ticket by such and such a date, we're going to suspend your license. So I went and I paid it, and then there was a glitch where they didn't get notified that I paid it, so they suspended my license, and I thought it was taken care of. But I got stopped by the police. They said, you're driving under a suspended license. I had done what I was told.
Yeah, that's still
and
so.
And then I ended up, and then I still, and then I lost my privilege again for driving under a suspended license, even though I was told if I pay this ticket,
Yeah.
Your license won't be suspended.
That is frustrating, Lisa. You know, it's sort of a two sides of the coin here. Let's also hear from David from the South End. David, go right ahead.
Hey, this is a little bit on the lighter side, but I stopped in Minnesota about 15 years ago. And during the interview with a policeman, he asked me if I'd take a breathalyzer test, which I did, and nervously, because I wasn't positive I'd pass it. And if I'd known that Massachusetts wasn't going to do anything, I might have declined that test. This isn't as serious as the events that have happened recently, but I should have known back then that the registry wasn't really on top of the job.
Yeah, so that is interesting, right? So what David is really underscoring is, if I know there's not going to be accountability, and, you know, that is particularly heartbreaking because the Globe has just reported in the last 24 hours that the driver of the June accident in New Hampshire that killed seven people was high on either a narcotic or amphetamine and was reaching for a drink when the accident occurred. So do we see practical consequences in people's behaviors when they think that their government is not enforcing, Tom?
Oh, absolutely, I think. I mean, it's across the board. I mean, and I get David's point. It is, you know, it's somewhat lighthearted, but I do think that there's a lot of people who driving out of state might now think that they don't have to obey the rules. What I'm really struck about here is the way that organizations function, how bad things can happen within organizations, and the information doesn't get up to anybody. And that's really the striking. People knew that these weren't being processed, but it never got elevated. And you always wonder with an organization, what was the systemic failure, the management failure that prevented bad news from going up?
So, Michael, I know you want to weigh in. I want to grab two more calls, and then I'm going to turn to you for last word on this. Charlie from Milford, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. My thought is that over the past few years, they have completely slashed their budget. They've laid off half the personnel. They've closed offices, but yet they still want the same results and the same work from the people. Now, I agree, it's a horrible situation that happened, but a lot of it we brought on ourselves.
Charlie, that's such an important point. Thanks for adding it to the mix. Let's take one more. Joe from Shrewsbury. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to relay a recent frustration I had with the RMV. I am a guy with a completely clean driving record. I applied for a real ID. They gave me hassle because my name matched some guy from another state. And the burden of proof was put on me to prove that I wasn't that guy rather than the RMV doing it. And it was a big hassle. And I was really annoyed thinking this is the same agency that failed to do something for that guy that got a commercial license and killed those people in New Hampshire.
Thanks.
So
for,
I was doubly annoyed.
Yeah, I that makes sense, Joe. And I'm going to turn to Michael Curry now. Yeah. We're hearing a lot of frustration on these calls, and there are more we're not even going to get to.
We are. So I think all of us have a horror story with the registered motor vehicles, and we can all share one even here. You know, they say elections have consequences, budgets have consequences, and your caller made a great point that if you underfund and under-resource any agency, these are the types of things that happen. In business, there is a fundamental thing that you always have to have is you have to have an audit department who looks at the risks and mitigates risk and looks at what could potentially happen and makes sure that things are processing properly. There should have been a function here that every level of the RMV and this administration should have been aware of what the risks were and what the processes that were put in place to mitigate those risks, that they were doing their jobs. I don't understand how this didn't happen.
Especially there was testimony from an auditor in the Department of Transportation that she had raised some of these flags actually in writing, I want to say 2015. And even after that, we didn't get results.
Yep.
All right, Michael, Tom, hang tight for a minute because our final topic this week is going to need some setup. And to join us to do that is John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and a blogger at It Is Good to Live in a Two-Daily Town. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Okay, so on Thursday, the Boston Herald page one depicted Governor Charlie Baker standing in a Chinese takeout container with the headline Walk Tall, Walk spelled W-O-K, with the subheadline Baker backs DeLeo's $5,000 Chinese feast. We're going to get to the objections that some have raised about that picture. But first of all, John, what was this story about?
Okay, this story was about
Robert DeLeo, the Speaker of the House, while they were doing the budget negotiations a couple of weeks ago, he ordered takeout for a whole bunch of people, and the bill came to $5,000. The Herald, roughly $5,000. The Herald comes across this, and this is mother's milk to the Herald. This is what the Herald does. And so they've been pounding away on it, and Charlie Baker seems to be okay with it. He doesn't have a problem with it. The subhead here, or the subtext, is secrecy, is that all kinds of things are happening in Massachusetts, especially around the legislature, that are not accessible to journalists or to the public. We have probably the worst transparency record in the United States, and it's not getting any better. So this is something where the Herald has sort of two points they're trying to make. One is this is extravagant, and two is, you know, it's really hard to find out what the lawmakers are doing, and three is that Charlie Baker's okay with it.
Okay, but that seemed to all get lost in the shuffle once we get this picture. So what was the reaction to the picture?
Okay, well, let me just say a couple of things for context here. This is not an excuse. This is just context. One is the Herald's revenue model. The Boston Herald has very few home subscribers. That means it has to sell the newspaper off the newsstand every day. And that's what leads to front pages like this. The other is that newsrooms, even though they cover the world, are very insulated places, and they can really be self-reinforcing in a lot of ways. Anyone who's been outdoors recently would know that this front page would be a Rorschach test for the entire city of Boston.
And how did Boston react?
Well, Boston reacted. For one thing, the lead thing was that Shirley Leung, business columnist for the Boston Globe, wrote a piece, with the headline, "Herald's Walk Tall Front Page is No Laughing Matter for Asian Americans." And, you know, basically she took she objected to this headline. And if you look at her piece in the Globe online and look at the comments section, everything is running true to form. It's completely evenly divided. One third positive, one third negative, one third this comment has been blocked. So, you know, this is basically exactly what you would expect from this. And for the Herald not to know that this was going to happen is something that is hard to understand, I think. But again, you know, newsrooms can be very isolated and basically they are self-reinforcing, self-propelling organizations.
So there is a value to having two newspapers. I mean, your blog is called It's Good to Live in a Two-Daily Town. Give us a little sense of the Herald's role in the Boston media landscape and how it plays out here.
Okay, for a long time, I thought the Herald was just sort of a lively index to the Boston Globe. That's no longer true. The Boston Globe and the Boston Herald live in parallel universes. They really occupy completely different spaces in the Boston media world. And the Boston Globe is traditional. It's the stately local broadsheet. It is going out. It has resources. The Herald, the feisty local tabloid, is out there trying to find the things that the Globe is not covering, trying to uncover corruption in government, mismanagement, those kinds of things. Things that play into a populist sensibility, things that sell off the newsstand. The Boston Herald's circulation is somewhere around 35,000 a day. You know, when I first moved to this town, the Boston Herald's circulation was 375,000 daily. So, you know, this is something where this is the amazing disappearing newspaper, and they're doing everything they can, and sometimes they go over the line. You know, this is one of the cases where a lot of people think they went over the line, but they're doing it for specific reasons, which is survival.
Okay,
and again, I'm not excusing them. I'm not even taking a side here. I'm just trying to set up the situation as it exists for the Herald.
All right, so this is the perfect time to bring back our other two panelists, Michael Curry, former president of the NAACP of Boston, and Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor. You know, it's a wide-open subject. I'm just going to let you both weigh in. Michael, you first.
Well, one, I have an experience with the Herald because in 2014, we were there meeting as an NAACP with them over the cartoonist with the Obama watermelon toothpaste issue. And I requested a meeting with community leaders, with then Pat Purcell at the Herald, and Joe Shaka, the editor-in-chief. And we had a very good conversation about the perception the hallway reputation of the Herald as a racist paper. And it was a very good conversation. It led to some diversity in their newsroom, an African-American being hired in a key position there. I think they've fallen down again, at least on this issue, because as Michelle Wu, city councilor, challenged them, that this may not be apparent to them, but to the Asian community, this was offensive, that this was an insensitivity. It may not be the exact same example as the watermelon toothpaste issue, but if you're an Asian American and you open that paper, someone in the room, if they were Asian, may have said to the folks at the table, let's not do this one. Let's not use this image. And I talked to Joe Shaka directly as a conversation about this issue, and he is remorseful of it. I think he realizes that this was one that probably should have had some different analysis and maybe a different decision. And I'm hoping that he and Michelle Wu, who've met, mm-hmm. will continue to meet and something good will come out of this. Asian Americans particularly have been discriminated against and dealt with this kind of stuff and not had a voice, a strong enough voice in this city to really push back at it. And Michelle, credit to her for doing that.
And Tom, you're a former Boston City Councilor, and Councilwoman Wu did push back on Twitter. So let me just turn to you.
Yeah, and actually the Herald today is running a piece about Michelle Wu and her pushback on it. And really does seem to me like it's walking up to the line of almost apologizing. And I suspect it's soon going to do that.
So you think this isn't the end of it? You think
no, it's
apologize?
Not. And I think they're going to apologize. And I thought Michelle Wu's comments to them were really very thoughtful, not over the line, not screaming back, but really trying to educate. And I think really she's done a masterful job of it.
So, John, while this is a painful moment, is there growth and learning to be had here? And how, as a city, do we go forward with that?
Well, as the reporters say, time will tell. I think that the Herald might say the right things. Tom's right. Up to now, they've sort of held off on the apology. Joe Shaka made a statement on their website yesterday saying the front page was purely a reference to Chinese food, but when a concern is raised that the words or images we use are hurtful, we do need to listen and apologize. But he didn't apologize. So I think that, that's step one. And maybe this is the six stages of apology that he's going to go through.
I think they're in the listening part right now, Jim.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And even if I could, very important that we pivot from this to the broader conversation around discrimination against Asian Americans. And I think there's a conversation, which I hope Michelle Wu can lead, that Asian Americans in New York Times article came out last year talking about how they're denied management leadership positions in companies, that we tend to tout them as smart and they get into schools and the stereotypes that come with that.
The model Asian stereotype.
The model Asian stereotype. But yet, if you look at corporate America, Asian American men, college educated, are paid 8% less than white men. Let's pivot to a conversation on what that discrimination looks like in the Asian community.
All right. Well, I want to have time for hubbub, so we're going to do this very quickly. But there was a story underneath this. So in a word, I'm going to ask each of you, did you have a problem with the $5,000? Yes or no? Tom?
No. With the transparency, yes, but not on the $5,000.
Michael?
No.
All right. John?
That's a lot of egg rolls. I think $5,000 is a lot of money. I don't know how many people were there, but I think that there's a sense that nobody's really paying attention, and that's one of the things that the Herald does well for to their credit. They may not do it in a totally unobjectionable way, but I think that that's their beat at this point. And that's something that's valuable. Not to plug my own blog, but a Two Daily Town is really rare these days in America. And to have a Two Daily Town is something that is really valuable to people because you get both sides, you get many sides. And I think that it really helps both papers, that they push each other and try to really be as relevant as they possibly can.
All right. That is the perfect note to shift to some other stories, which we like to call our hubbubs. These are the brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tom, you got a hubbub?
I do. So just about a month from now, Boston holds its preliminary election for city council. As always, in an off year, it's probably going to be a low turnout election. Or maybe not. This year, the field of candidates is exceptionally big. 15 will be on the ballot for just 4 at-large seats.
Wow.
2 years ago, by contrast, there were only 8 candidates. Now, that's a lot of folks who will be out there on the street urging voters to go to the polls. And personally, I hope they do. For all that we focus on national politics, it's really at the local level that stuff gets done. Think about the things that most of us really care about. Schools, public safety, transportation, housing affordability, the built environment, even trash and snow removal, all local. As Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. It's easy to rail against the guy in the White House, but if you really want to change things, start small.
All right. Well, that was pretty inspiring. So, Michael, I'm going to make you go next.
So I'm going to keep it quick. But I think with the Republican parties in Congress ineptitude in dealing with the breach of our national security, particularly our voting, our election process, it's interesting to me. The news out of this week was that Will Hurd, one of the only two African-American members of Congress, one in the Senate and one in the House, he is leaving Congress, a Republican from Texas, large part his frustration with his party. Right. He voted against the comment that Donald Trump made to the four women, one being Ayanna from Massachusetts. He's not happy with Congress's inaction on protecting our election and is about to leave Congress and focus on the interconnection between technology and national security. I think it's funny that a person has to leave Congress to do the work that he could have done in Congress. And by the way, six other Republicans are also leaving Congress as well.
Which is something to know. It really is. John, we didn't invite you to give one, but if you happen to have a hubbub, let's hear it.
Okay, one thing we didn't talk about was Twitter, the Smashbox sandbox, Smash Mouth sandbox that people play in. Somebody dug up an article that Shirley Leung wrote for the Wall Street Journal back in 2003, and the headline was, "Big chains talk the talk, but can't walk the walk."
Now,
to be fair, it's very possible that Shirley Leung did not write that headline. But FAIR and Twitter very rarely appear in the same sentence.
Yeah, and it is a good point that often writers don't get to write their own headlines. It certainly is striking at the end of this week, given this conversation. All right, John Carroll, WBUR senior news analyst and blogger at It's Good to Live in a Two Daily Town. John, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board. Michael, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Hey, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.